Greetings, Sonia Smolikholm. Are you on the line?
Yes, I am here. Kehalani, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you so much for joining us today on Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond from your office at the United Nations in New York City.
Thank you. And it's a very cold, cold day here in New York.
I'm sorry. It's cold here in Connecticut, too. I'd like to start by asking I'd like to start by asking if you could briefly tell our listeners a bit about your personal background, as well as how you came to work at the United Nations in the realm of Indigenous rights.
Okay. Well, I'm an Indigenous person from Australia. I'm a member of the Murrumbininji people, which are from the very north of Australia. And I'm also the eldest of the 11 children. Mm. And in my younger years, my father was what's called a stockman or a rancher, I think it's called, in the US. Mm-hmm. So we lived a lot on cattle ranches throughout the region. And my father worked and contributed to a very important industry because the cattle industry was actually the backbone of the, you know, the funding for the north of Australia.
Mm-hmm.
So my father, along with a number of Indigenous men and women, were employed in these ranches because they knew a lot of the, knowledge of the landscape and the capacity to track horses and cattle. They knew the landscape very well. So they were sought after to assist with this important work.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my early years were spent doing that. Later on in years, of course, I went off to school and went to university and then decided I wanted to do something else in my life. And what I used to do was look at the United Nations website quite a lot, particularly for jobs. And a job came up and I applied for it and was lucky enough to get it. So the job I'm in at the moment is called, it's got a strange name, like a social affairs officer.
Yes.
But it's with the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, and it's based here in New York. We're a very small office. We're only 10 people in an office, but we deal with Indigenous people's issues throughout the world.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And how long have you been with the Permanent Forum?
Going on to my 6 years. So, been longer than I thought it would be, but 5 years last November, and this year's into my 6th year.
Right. Well, and the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues isn't that old either. Could you tell us when it was established and how it works? I've talked about the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples on the show and have had several guests, but we've never done an in-depth look at the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues.
Right. Well, the Permanent Forum is actually one of three United Nations body that is mandated to deal specifically with Indigenous peoples' issues.
Mm-hmm.
The other two are the Expert Mechanism on the Rights of Indigenous People, which is not very old either, and also the Special Rapporteur on Indigenous Peoples.
Mm-hmm.
The Permanent Forum was established in 2000, the year 2000, and it has a mandate. Before I talk about the mandate, it is an advisory body to the Economic and Social Council,
mm-hmm.
which ECOSOC, which is a body under the General Assembly here at the United Nations. And the issues we're mandated to discuss are economic and social development, culture, the environment, education, health and human rights.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically providing advice and recommendations to the Economic and Social Council. One of our biggest roles, of course, is to coordinate Indigenous peoples' issues right across the United Nations system.
Mm-hmm.
So we're hoping that all the United Nations bodies and systems will eventually focus on Indigenous peoples' issues.
Right.
So that's my work in the Secretariat. But, of course, the Permanent Forum itself has 16 members. And the Secretariat is where I work, and we support those 16 members. And the 16 members are chosen 8 by Indigenous peoples' organisations and
mm-hmm.
8 by governments. And they come from the different regions around the world.
Mm-hmm.
The Permanent Forum has 7 regions. So, And the United Nations has five regions, but we have a two extra regions. And the regions are based on social and cultural similarities. For example, the Pacific includes places like Hawaii, Rapa Nui, New Zealand, Australia, all the Pacific islands. So, you know, there is quite a lot of similarities, I guess, between the cultures in that region.
Right. And what are the seven regions for the permanent forum beside, what are the other six beside the Pacific?
Okay. One is the, I had to write this down because I'd always forget. But of course, the Pacific, which I've just told you.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is Asia, Africa, Central and South America and the Caribbean, the Arctic, and a huge one, which is the Central and Eastern Europe, Russian Federation, Central Asia, and Transcaucasia. That's one big region, and North America.
Right.
So they're the seven regions.
Okay. And in terms of those categories, who counts or who is considered indigenous within the permanent forum? We know here in North America that's a contested issue across many different communities and tribal governments and vis-a-vis state and federal governments in terms of blood quantum, citizenship. I mean, we just spoke with Marilyn Vann and she talked about the descendants of the freedmen being excluded and now re-enfranchised. But in terms of the permanent forum, you know, I recall over a decade ago hearing that white Afrikaners from South Africa were trying to claim indigenous status. You know, what are sort of the bounds around that identity in this kind of forum?
That's the issue, I guess. The United Nations has no definition of indigenous people, in the same way it has no definition of terrorism or minorities. Of families, it doesn't have any of those kinds of definitions. So it's open. We base it on self-identification. And, of course, that's not, I'm not saying it's easy because, as you say, you know, there are other groups that also consider or try to consider themselves indigenous. But we don't have, the United Nations just doesn't have a definition of indigenous people. So it is based on self-selection.
Right. And that on the one hand supports the principle of self-determination, so that you don't want settler states defining who counts and who doesn't, because often they'll count people out of existence for their own to their own benefit. But then on the other hand, you know, indigenous broadly speaking, you know, we talk in communities about fourth world status, that is being a minority in your own homeland, often dealing with a settler colonial state, and other kinds of indexes of it being sort of a political status, and then there's the cultural elements of sort of what indigenous peoples might loosely have in common that differs from, say, Eastern or Western cultures.
Yes, yeah, and also there is a, people often make a mistake of thinking that indigenous people and minorities are the same people, and they're not. Indigenous people, of course, are based, you know, there are sort of broad definitions. If you read some of the reports that were written in the early days in the 1970s on Indigenous people by UN rapporteurs, they talk about there were certain, not categories, but certain things that defined Indigenous people, particularly like links to land, ancestral land, language. And they're a little bit different to, say, minorities. I'm not saying that minorities don't have the same kind of links, but often minorities have a specific issue, probably more issues-based, whereas Indigenous peoples tend to be more land-based.
Right.
So I guess that's kind of the thing that we often look at is, you know, what are the, you know, if someone comes forward and says they're Indigenous, I, you know, often sort of think, well, what connection do you have to an Indigenous peoples group? Or which groups do you represent? And where is your land? And what language links as well? So they're the kinds of things, I guess, that we kind of consider, particularly, you know, when we're registering people for the permanent forum. So that way it kind of is kind of linked to who are Indigenous people and who are not.
Mm-hmm. So one can make some broad generalizations,
mm-hmm.
you know, for the purpose of the political organizing that happens there
that's
at the
right.
forum, and that's different from, say, the issues facing linguistic minorities,
yeah.
ethnic minorities, racial minorities.
Yes.
That's what sets indigeneity apart from ethnicity and race.
That's right. It does,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, for our listeners who may be unfamiliar with this, I know the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues meets for 10 days each year at the UN headquarters in New York City. Sonia, that next meeting, if I understand correctly, is May 16th through the 27th, 2011?
That's right, yes.
What is the work that's done at these sessions, and what is the thematic focus for this year's meeting?
Okay. We don't have a thematic focus this year because we have a work method where one year we have a thematic focus,
mm-hmm.
and the following year we have a review year. And this year is a review year, and there are a lot of UN agencies work like this. And the review year is we look at what has been done over the years within the Permanent Forum,
mm-hmm.
what are some of the recommendations that have been made, and have they been implemented? How's the status of implementation? And this year we're looking at three areas of implementation, and that is economic and social development,
mm-hmm.
Environment, and free, prior and informed consent.
Mm-hmm.
And human rights is always on the agenda. So each year, because it's such a popular area, a lot of Indigenous people are really keen to talk about human rights issues. So that's always on the agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And also this year we have a half a day on a discussion on the Central and South America and the Caribbean,
mm-hmm.
and a half a day on Indigenous peoples and water. So they'll be sort of the main focus of the meeting. And, of course, there's another big issue that's coming up that's just been passed in the General Assembly last December is an issue of a world conference on Indigenous peoples in 2014.
Mm.
So that will also, I guess, be discussed as well.
I see.
So that's what we'll do for those 10 days. It's a very, very interesting time because, you know, we have up to 1,500 to 1,800 Indigenous people in New York.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge meeting. We're the second biggest meeting here at the United Nations. The first one is the Commission on the Status of Women.
Yes.
And we're next. And it's security people tell me that it's the most colourful meeting that ever takes place in the UN because people come in their traditional dress, mm-hmm. and people travel far. And, you know, Indigenous people aren't wealthy people either, so they save up their money and come to New York for 2 weeks, which isn't cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to be heard. And the big part of the meeting, of course, is the networking. So, you know, like-minded groups meet around certain issues. Or it's just a really, for me, the most stimulating time of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And also time for people to talk about their issues back at home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to bring it to an international forum, I think, is something really important.
Yes, and exciting, too.
It is. I really love it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of getting into just some specific examples for listeners who might think this is very abstract or very legalistic, how does the work of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues use, say, the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples as a point of reference for standards in terms of how states should treat Indigenous peoples? You mentioned the three areas that will be the focus of this meeting, economic, social development, the environment, and also free, prior, and informed consent.
Yeah.
Could you maybe just take one of those as an example? And what are the kinds of issues of how, say, free, prior, and informed consent is something that is discussed in the declaration? How might that get taken up at the UN Permanent Forum?
Okay, a really good one. If I look at, for example, environment is actually my area.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very broad area, so it takes in from things like biodiversity on Indigenous people's lands, right through to forests, to water. And also, it also considers things like, it touches on economic and social development, you know, things like where there are developments occurring on Indigenous people's lands.
Mm-hmm.
And before that development can occur, one of the things that the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples talk about is that there must be free, prior, informed consent. Indigenous people must be able to discuss with, whether it's governments or whether it's private companies or whoever is wanting to use the land for whatever reason,
mm-hmm.
that Indigenous people must, there must be prior informed consent. Now, the consent can, it can be not consent. So Indigenous people can discuss this and decide at the end of their discussions
mm-hmm.
that they don't want this to happen. So that, or they can agree that that the land can be used for other purposes. But it is a an area that Indigenous peoples themselves need to be made aware of what is taking place on their land
mm-hmm.
to be able to discuss it and then decide whether or not they want that to happen.
Right.
So it's a process that has to occur, you know, from the beginning of a project throughout the project and at the end of the project.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it can be from even like research, you know, people going on to Indigenous people's lands to research Indigenous people. It can be something like that,
right
through to a major company wanting to mine or, you know, extractive industries or to build a dam or to build a road.
Mm-hmm.
it's all those kinds of issues that just companies or governments just shouldn't just think that they can just go ahead with it without talking to Indigenous people about it first and getting the permission to do so.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And related to that, I recently read that the Australian Human Rights Commission in Australia just released a guide to the UN Declaration on Indigenous Rights that explains how, say, Indigenous Australians can use the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And why I thought of that just now is that communities around the globe are still learning about how they can invoke these rights, how they can actually, you know, call upon states to, you know, solicit their free, prior and informed consent. In the Australia example, could you maybe discuss how the Indigenous peoples there use its principles and reinforce its legitimacy, if there's any cases that you might want to mention briefly?
Right. You know, you're right there about saying that Indigenous people are still learning about this. because when this, I mean, even though this declaration took over 20 years to be drafted to it being passed in the General Assembly,
mm-hmm.
a lot of people still aren't aware of its contents or what it means or what is it there for? What's its purpose? And that's one of the big things that we talk about and what we're quite concerned about is the sort of capacity building that's required in Indigenous communities
mm-hmm.
that rights are now enshrined in a declaration. And these are not new rights. These are rights that have been in all human rights standards.
Mm-hmm.
And that they've just been put in a way that that suits Indigenous people. So there is a lot of catching up to do for Indigenous people to understand it and also to work out how does it work for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is what the Australian Human Rights Commission was trying to do, was to do a guide in what they called plain language, you know, without the legalistic terms,
mm-hmm.
and to give examples of how Indigenous people can use the declaration. And I just don't have that copy in front of me at the moment, but they did have some really important examples, and I'm just trying to think of one off the top of my head, which would be free, prior, informed consent, that
mm-hmm.
there is a process to go through. So if a researcher turns up in your community and wants to do research, you have the right, as Indigenous people, to negotiate that research
mm-hmm.
and how it... how that research will take place in your community. So it's really important things like that. It's really important that things like having a road being built through your community
mm-hmm.
or people having access to certain things in your community. So it's really trying to have people understand that there are rights, and Indigenous people have those rights to negotiate that kind of thing. It's not something that can just be done.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the Australian Human Rights Commission was trying to say in that guide that they released. Now, in terms of an Australian example about how Indigenous people are using its principles to reinforce its legitimacy, I think because I haven't been in the country, I'm not quite sure. There has been some discussion around, I think the government is, you know, for example, the Australian government is looking at putting nuclear waste on Indigenous people's land. Mm. And there is a section within the declaration that talks about that.
Mm-hmm.
That has to be done with the free, prior, informed consent of Indigenous people. But in terms of the declaration, other examples in the world is, for example, Bolivia, the country of Bolivia, has made the declaration into a national law.
Mm-hmm.
And they also had a referendum to adopt a new constitution, which incorporates the rights and principles from the declaration.
Right.
And there are other sort of federated states that support the declaration that came out, you know, after the declaration was passed in 2007. And interesting enough, some of those states were like the Northwest Territories in Canada,
mm-hmm.
The governments of Hawaii and the governments of Arizona and Maine all supported the declaration. Now, it's one thing to come out and support it. I guess the next thing is the implementation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where the, you know, that's where the crux lies. That's where Indigenous people and governments need to talk more about how is it implemented on the ground.
Right.
What do people see from it?
Yes, and that will largely, you know, that will have to be also in response to Indigenous peoples actually mobilizing and agitating. And we'll see how the states respond to that, eh?
Exactly, yes.
And for our listeners who are new to this issue, the Obama administration just recently endorsed the UN Declaration because the United States, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada were the only four countries in the world that actually voted against the mm-hmm. adoption of that at the General Assembly in 2007. Sonia, just, you know, thinking about the Australian Human Rights Commission releasing this guide to the UN Declaration, I mean, I'm not asking you to necessarily weigh in on U.S. policy, but I'd like to just say I can't imagine at this stage, say, we don't have a Human Rights Commission, number one. But,
mm-hmm.
but number two, you know, even the U.S. Department of Justice, I mean, that would be quite something if the U.N. Department of Justice were to even consider releasing a guide such as this. So I just want to raise that because I want to encourage listeners to sort of think about this expansively and how, in the absence of that, at least for now, Indigenous communities and other allies, might think about doing these community guides themselves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, that's correct. And also, one of the things that we're also looking at is translating the declaration into the local languages.
Mm.
And it's happening in many parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Again, but I have not seen one in any of the Native American languages.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't even think I've even seen one in the Native Hawaiian languages, to be quite honest. And Australian languages, I haven't seen any in any of the Indigenous languages from Australia. So we're a little bit behind, whereas, you know, Latin America, there's heaps in different languages.
Mm-hmm.
There's already one in Maori language. So, you know, there are quite a number in different languages, and we're just a little bit behind.
Mm.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about that. Thanks for raising that.
Mm.
We're running out of time, but before we close, I want to be sure to ask you, I understand that the Secretariat, you, of the Permanent Forum, organized an expert group meeting on Indigenous peoples and forests that was held last week in New York. What was the meeting about and who attended?
Right, the meeting was last week, and it was on Indigenous peoples and forests, and the people who attended, we had seven experts from the seven regions of the world.
Mm-hmm.
We also had four Permanent Forum members. And we had governments and United Nations agencies, as well as Indigenous peoples organisations and academics. And I guess interesting when we talk about forests, because the whole issue of who owns forest is always one of the underlying issues.
Mm-hmm.
So land issues is always, a really important issue. And, of course, that's been the major area of conflict in the world between Indigenous peoples and governments and also private investors over forests because, you know, the Indigenous people have managed to keep forests going for many, many, you know, thousands and thousands of years. Mm-hmm. And then you have people wanting to, you know, do the logging and... use the land for other purposes, you know, make them into parks, national parks and whatever. And there's huge areas of conflict. So those were some of the issues that we talked about last week.
Mm-hmm.
And also, just briefly, this year, 2011, is the International Year of Forests. So one of the big issues, of course, is to try and raise the visibility of Indigenous peoples in forests. Because people just see forests as something to be... used for other purposes and they think they're empty. But in fact, forests aren't empty. They're full of Indigenous people and Indigenous people have survived there for many years. So it's about, I guess, trying to, you know, this is the stuff that came out last week in the meeting is to how Indigenous people can still maintain their living conditions and standards in forests and maintain the forest. And it's self-determination if Indigenous people want to use forests for other purposes that, again, it's done in a way that suits the people of the forest.
Right, and that's linked to customary practices of living on the land.
Yes.
What was the outcome of the meeting and what's the next step?
Well, the outcome of the meeting was a range of recommendations that will go to different bodies, whether they go to the UN bodies or go to governments. You know, as I said, one of the things was the trying to raise the visibility of Indigenous people within the this year of the forest. And this this report of this meeting will now go to the permanent forum session in May and discuss further there.
Right.
So it's kind of a, it just starts off the discussion and then, of course, once we get to the forum, people can read it and then make more interventions on the report and see what comes out of that.
Oh, excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in conclusion, I just want to ask you, besides this issue of forest lands and Indigenous occupancy, at an international level, if you could leave our listeners with some thoughts of what you think the main issues are for Indigenous peoples in your view.
I think land is still a really big issue. And I think the other area is, of course, recognition of as Indigenous people. Many parts of the world, Indigenous people are still not recognised for who they are, or they're denied their rights and denied their identity. I think so. Land and who are Indigenous people are really important. And I think, of course, as the world goes on, I think there are lots of things that are affecting Indigenous peoples, like climate change, like big development practices. And I think one of the things is having Indigenous peoples' voices in all these major things that are going on, particularly, for example, in climate change. Because Indigenous people, again, have managed their lands for thousands of years and do have practices that can... mitigate against things like climate change, and people often forget that or don't even consider that Indigenous people have those practices. And it's so, again, it's about Indigenous people having that voice in the way that, you know, we take care of the land and the way that we've managed to maintain our lands over thousands of years and trying to get that kind of voice out there to people in the world. So they are what I see as the major issues. And, of course, there's still, you know, lots of things like living standards are really poor and there's still so we still have a long, long way to go.
Right. Okay, well, thank you so much for educating us. I really appreciate you being on Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be on your show.
Oh, we'll be in touch, Sonia.
Yes.
Okay, take good care. Mahalo.
Okay, bye.